So imagine stepping into like a lavish, super exclusive royal birthday party. You're surrounded by a paranoid dictator, the region's most elite politicians, military commanders.
Right, the absolute upper crust of society.
Exactly. The wine is flowing, the music is loud, and well, the night ends with a severed head being served to the king on a silver platter.
Yeah, that really does not sound like your typical serene Sunday school lesson, does it?
No, not at all.
It honestly sounds much more like the climax of, I don't know, a premium cable historical thriller.
Yeah.
The whole pastoral imagery of shepherds and like quiet morality that we usually associate with ancient texts is just completely stripped away here.
Totally gone.
Yeah, we are looking at this brutal, high-stakes collision of power and fear.
Which is why we are so excited to welcome you to another deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack the intense political intrigue, the moral conflicts, and honestly, the deep, crippling royal insecurity found in Matthew chapter
It
14.
is a wild chapter.
It really is.
Yeah.
And to do this, we've gathered a really fascinating stack of sources for you. We're pulling from historical analyses of the Herodian dynasty, theological commentaries, and even sociological research into the honor and shame cultures of first century Galilee.
Right. And by combining those specific types of sources, we get to bypass the sort of stained glass window version of this narrative.
Synthesized version, yeah.
Exactly. The historical context transforms this from just a simple morality tale into, well, basically a masterclass on the psychology of state authority.
It really does.
Because we're looking at a powder keg of religious expectations that was, barely being contained by this super fragile system of Roman appeasement.
Right, because to understand why the rulers in this story were just sweating bullets,
Yeah.
we have to look at the political map of first century Galilee. And according to our sources, it was highly, highly fragmented.
Oh, incredibly fragmented.
Like Rome didn't just hand over the keys to a single powerful king.
No, they engineered a geopolitical mess on purpose.
On purpose.
Yeah, I mean, after the death of Herod the Great, Rome really wanted to prevent any single local leader from consolidating too much power and, launching a rebellion.
Because rebellions are bad for business.
Exactly. So the Roman emperor divided the territory among Herod's sons. You have Archelaus, Philip, and then the primary figure in our text today, Herod Antipas.
Herod Antipas.
Right. And Antipas is given the title of Tetrarch over the regions of Galilee and Perea. And that title is crucial.
Because it means he's not the main guy, right?
Right. It literally translates to the ruler of a fourth part. He is absolutely not the supreme sovereign.
So he only has partial control over the territories where all this drama, specifically the rising ministry of Jesus, is actually happening.
Exactly.
You know, I was trying to wrap my head around this dynamic, and it feels exactly like a messy corporate restructuring.
Oh, that is a great analogy.
Right, like Rome is the ruthless CEO sitting at corporate headquarters demanding quarterly profits and absolute unquestioning order.
Yeah, and zero excuses.
Exactly. And Herod Antipas and his brothers are essentially middle managers. They've been handed these newly divided, highly volatile regional departments.
Yes.
So they have very limited actual power, but they are constantly looking over their shoulders, trying to keep the local employees in line.
That is so spot on. But you have to take that corporate analogy and like raise the stakes
Yeah,
significantly.
because getting fired meant something else back then.
Oh, yeah. In Rome's corporate structure, getting fired by the CEO didn't mean losing your pension. It often meant assassination or permanent exile.
Wow. Okay. So much higher stakes.
To Rome, a tetrarch who cannot control the local populace is entirely useless. So in this really fragile setup, any charismatic figure or prophetic voice or grassroots movement isn't just a localized nuisance.
Right. It's an existential threat. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a direct threat to the tetrarch's political legitimacy and his actual life.
Because if you're Herod Antipas and your region gets unruly, Rome marches in with legions and just removes you.
Yep. You are living in a constant state of paranoia. Herod's political grip was just incredibly brittle.
So he couldn't afford a popular uprising.
No, and perhaps even more dangerously in that culture, he could not afford public embarrassment.
Which brings us perfectly to a massive, highly publicized
A
embarrassment.
banquet.
Yes, a
Yeah.
banquet. Because Herod's fragile grip on power directly leads into his disastrous, lethal handling of a man named John the Baptist.
Right.
Our sources highlight this flashback in the text to a royal banquet that goes horribly wrong.
Right.
But the tension for this banquet actually starts much earlier, right?
Yeah.
With a deeply personal, very loud moral critique from John.
Yeah, John the Baptist was this wildly popular prophetic figure who really commanded the attention of the masses, and he had been publicly, relentlessly condemning Herod Antipas.
But not just for, like, general government corruption, right?
No, no. John specifically targeted Herod's unlawful marriage to a woman named Herodias. And to add a layer of just intense familial drama to
this... Oh, this part is wild.
Right. Herodias was the ex-wife of Herod's own brother, Philip.
I mean, for a listener today, that might just sound like scandalous tabloid gossip.
Yeah, totally.
But in a highly religious first century society, legitimacy comes from adhering to the law.
Exactly.
So if a prophet out in the wilderness is telling the peasants that the ruler sitting in the palace is violating the fundamental laws of their religion, that completely delegitimizes Herod.
Yes.
It is a full-blown political crisis just masquerading as a family scandal.
That's a perfect way to put it. The populace is already primed to reject Roman-appointed rulers anyway, and John is essentially handing them the theological justification to do exactly that.
So how does Herod respond?
Well, he responds with state power. He arrests John and throws him in prison. But, and this is key, he hesitates to kill him because he knows how popular John is.
He's trying to manage the optics.
Exactly. It's all about optics.
Okay, so then we get to the banquet. Herod throws this massive birthday celebration for himself. He invites his military commanders, the high officials, and, you know, the leading men of Galilee.
All the heavy hitters in one room.
Right. And during this lavish, alcohol-soaked dinner, Herodias totally manipulates the situation.
Yeah.
She has her daughter dance for Herod and his elite guests.
Yeah.
And Herod is so pleased, or I don't know, maybe just so caught up in the revelry of the moment, that he makes this massive public oath to give the daughter whatever she wants.
Up to half his kingdom, which is a wild thing to say.
It is.
Yeah.
And prompted entirely by her mother, who has a severe vendetta against John, the daughter asks for the head of John the Baptist on a platter.
It's just a brutal power play.
It is.
Yeah.
But I have to push back here. Or at least ask the question that was just screaming in my head while I was reading this historical breakdown.
Okay, lay it on me.
Matthew 14, verses 9 and 10. Explicitly says, quote, "The king was distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he ordered that her request be granted and had John beheaded in the prison."
Right.
Why would a ruler, a guy who commands military and literally holds the power of life and death, care so much about the opinions of his dinner guests that he executes a man he knows he shouldn't?
That is the big question. And to understand it, we really have to unpack the psychology of ancient honor and shame cultures.
Okay.
In our modern Western world, we might view, you know, changing your mind or admitting a mistake as a sign of maturity. But in first century Galilee, honor was a tangible currency.
Like, it had actual value.
Yes. It was the glue that held social and political hierarchies together. And Herod is sitting in a room full of sharks, his military commanders, his rival elites.
Oh, I see. If you've ever felt trapped into doing something you knew was wrong just because you made, like, a boastful promise in front of your coworkers, you actually understand a fraction of Herod's psychology in this moment.
Yeah, that peer pressure is intense.
It reminds me of a modern politician who gets backed into a corner on live television. They make some ill-advised, off-the-cuff promise.
Oh, we've all seen that.
Right?
Yeah.
And instead of just walking it back and admitting they misspoke, they double down.
Right.
They prioritize their public image over basic, fundamental justice just to avoid looking weak in front of their peers.
Exactly. And the text even notes that the king was distressed. He understood the political danger of killing a popular prophet.
But his ego was just too fragile.
Yes. If he retracts his oath because he is afraid of a peasant prophet, he loses face in front of the very men he needs to help him maintain military control over the region.
And a ruler who loses face invites rebellion.
Precisely. His need to maintain the illusion of absolute power in front of his court forced his hand into committing an atrocity.
He's terrified of looking like he's not in charge, which ironically proves to you as the listener that he isn't really in charge of his own court at all.
He's totally trapped.
Yeah, he's a prisoner of his own prestige, manipulated by his wife and trapped by his guests.
And the blood on Herod's hands at this banquet creates a profound psychological fallout. Because violence in a powder keg society doesn't extinguish a fire.
It acts as an accelerant.
Exactly. And we see the horrific consequences of this when the timeline of the text catches up to the present and a new threat emerges.
right? The text shows Herod starting to hear reports about Jesus. Jesus is gaining immense fame. He's performing miracles and drawing massive crowds.
The exact same demographic that used to follow John the Baptist.
Exactly. And how does the Tetrarch react? He completely loses his grip on reality. Matthew 14, verses 1 and 2, details Herod hearing these reports and immediately telling his attendants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead."
That is why miraculous powers are at work in him.
Right. It is a staggering confession of terror from a head of state.
It really is.
So is this genuine belief in ghosts? Or is this just the ultimate extreme manifestation of a guilty conscience? Because the irony here is incredibly thick. You have a man who commands armies, who lives in a heavily guarded fortress, and he is absolutely terrified of a dead man.
Well, it's really a volatile mixture of both. I mean, the ancient world was steeped in superstitious terror anyway.
Sure.
And Herod's crushing guilty conscience just amplifies that fear. But on a much deeper systemic level, this reaction represents the defining ultimate anxiety of state authority.
Let's explore that anxiety a bit. What exactly is Herod realizing in this moment?
Well, think about the tools available to a dictator. Herod used the ultimate final tool of the state to solve his problem: violence, execution, the sword.
Right.
He severed the head of his critic to crush the movement, and his immediate assumption upon hearing about Jesus is that the violence failed.
The execution didn't work.
Exactly. The movement didn't die with the man, it regenerated.
He realizes he cannot kill a grassroots religious movement with a sword. That has to be a terrifying moment for a ruler whose only real leverage is the threat of death.
Oh, absolutely.
You play your ultimate trump card, and the problem just comes back stronger with, quote, miraculous powers.
It shatters the entire illusion of his power. He thought he solved his political crisis at that blood-soaked banquet, but all he did was set the stage for a much larger, unstoppable phenomenon.
So Herod thinks the execution solved his problem, but he actually just created a ghost that is haunting his administration.
Yep.
Which explains the utter panic we see next. Because while Herod is stewing in this intense paranoia in his palace, the narrative brilliantly pivots.
It's such a good shift.
The sources show us the striking visual contrast between how the state operates and how this new movement operates.
The gospel writer executes a masterful literary pivot right here. We move abruptly from the claustrophobic, violent paranoia of the royal court out into the open expanse of the wilderness.
Right. So Jesus hears about John's death. He senses this rising heat and anxiety emanating from Herod's palace, so he strategically withdraws by boat to a desolate place.
Smart move.
Very smart. He doesn't organize an armed rebellion. He just steps away from the machinery of the state entirely. But the people, the masses who are hurting and hungry, they don't care about Herod's borders or Rome's authority.
That's not all.
They bypass the state authorities completely and follow Jesus on foot from the towns.
And this mass migration into the wilderness leads to one of the most iconic and politically charged moments in the ancient text.
The feeding of the 5,000.
Exactly.
So Jesus sees these massive crowds arriving in this desolate place. He is moved with compassion. He heals their sick. And then he feeds them all with just 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish.
It's an incredible scene.
Matthew 14, verses 19 and 20, specifically points out that they all ate, were satisfied, and there were 12 basketfuls of broken pieces left over.
And if we look closely at the sociological and historical frameworks our sources provide, the implications of this wilderness feast are massive.
Oh, yeah.
We are looking at a deliberate, devastating contrast of leadership here.
Picture the split-screen visual for a second. On one side of the screen, you have Herod, a paranoid, illegitimate middle manager king sitting in a lavish, corrupt palace, serving up a banquet of death to protect his own ego.
Right.
And then on the other side of the screen, out in the dusty, uncontrolled wilderness, you have Jesus, a figure offering actual, tangible provision, healing, and a banquet of life for the masses, asking nothing in return.
And a first century audience would not just see 2 different meals, they would instantly catch the massive historical echoes ringing through this narrative.
Tell us about those echoes.
Well, the text is brilliantly framing Herod and Herodias as the reincarnations of the wicked King Ahab and Queen Jezebel from their ancient history.
Unpack that connection for us, because those are heavy names in this historical context.
You really are. So Centuries earlier, King Ahab and Queen Jezebel were the ultimate corrupt, violent royals of Israel. Jezebel famously manipulated the political system and used state violence to murder an innocent man just to steal his vineyard.
Wow, okay.
And they were opposed by the wilderness-dwelling prophet Elijah, who constantly called out their corruption. So by showing Herodias manipulating Herod to murder John the Baptist, the text is telling the listener, look, the corrupt, violent state of Ahab and Jezebel is back.
Which means the ghost of Elijah must be back too.
Precisely. John the Baptist and Jesus are taking on the mantles of those mighty anti-establishment prophets, Elijah and Elisha.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. If you are a first century peasant, you don't just see a guy handing out bread in the desert. You see the continuation of the ultimate prophetic resistance against a corrupt crown.
So Jesus isn't just feeding them. He is ringing a massive historical alarm bell that terrifyingly echoes right into Herod's palace.
It is a clash of ancient archetypes playing out in real time. And the miracle itself, you know, providing bread in a desolate place, has its own massive historical weight.
Right, because of the Exodus.
Exactly. Providing miraculous bread in the wilderness is a direct echo of God's provision of manna during the Exodus, when the people were liberated from the oppressive state of Egypt.
So by feeding the masses in the wilderness, Jesus is acting as a new Moses, offering liberation and provision that the current oppressive state just cannot touch.
It solidifies Jesus's messianic identity while completely undermining the Roman-appointed rulers. It demonstrates that true authority, the kind that actually cares for, heals, and sustains the populace, flows through divine power, not through Roman decrees.
Herod is rendered entirely irrelevant to the people's actual daily needs.
Absolutely. The state is providing death. The wilderness is providing abundant life, signified by those 12 baskets of leftovers.
Herod is just a guy trapped in a palace with a sword, while the real power is out in the desert handing out bread.
Right.
It perfectly captures why the ruling class was so deeply terrified. They held the official titles, they collected the taxes, but they possessed absolutely zero real authority over the hearts and minds of the people.
And when we look at this intense historical dynamic and the profound paranoia of the ruling class, it leaves us with a lingering question.
What's that?
Well, what happens to a society when the state realizes its swords, its executions, and its prisons are entirely useless against an idea or a movement that has already captured the hearts of the masses?
Man, that is such a heavy, incredible question to leave off on. And I want to know what all of you listening think about that. Drop a comment below with your thoughts on today's historical drama.
Yeah, we love reading those.
We really do. What stood out to you about the intense political parallels? Do you see that messy corporate restructuring playing out in the history? Or maybe you recognize the trap of the honor and shame culture? Let us know in the comments.
And hey, if you enjoyed this.
Yes. If you enjoyed today's deep dive and love unpacking these historical powder kegs with us, make sure you hit that like button and subscribe. It genuinely helps the show.
It really does.
Also, do not forget to check the description below for exclusive links to the historical analyses and sociological resources we use for today's topic. You will not want to miss our next deep dive. I can already tease that it is going to be even more intense than this one. Thank you so much for joining the conversation. We will see you next time.